Hello, John.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's I'm glad to have you on. In fact, unfortunately, I've been so involved in Kickstarters of my own nonsense. Occasionally I pay attention to what's going on around me. It's like it's like, oh, the basic expert's doing something cool on Kickstarter. It's like, why don't I just have the basic expert on? But before we go too far, I need to know, is it where do you put the emphasis? Are you the basic expert? Are you the basic expert? Are you the basic expert?
It's all equal, I'd say. Just the basic expert, you know.
Okay.
It's sort of a, it was a, for me, like a fun, like self-depreciating thing. 'Cause, you know, there's a whole thing of like, ah, that person's basic, or like, you know, basic white chick or something like that. But then also I like BX. So, you know, it's like a little self-depreciating, but also a homage to my, one of my favorite editions of D&D. So,
So why is that your favorite version of D&D?
I think when I finally left fifth edition, that was what I kind of gravitated towards, like rule cyclopedia style D&D. And I really enjoyed it, and I really got like sucked into it. And I liked the clones, like old school centrals, and even basic fantasy, which I think is a great alternative to, you know, modern D&D if you want to get into old school on a budget, because PDFs are free. You can't beat that.
Right.
And I don't know. There's just a special charm to BX. I mean, I've come to really love like OD&D. Makuhito, my Kickstarter is white box, so that's zero edition, you know. But I like AD&D. But I don't know. I just BX just has that like special place for me.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and everybody has their own tastes, and I don't personally like fifth edition that much, but I don't really have I'm never going to argue somebody with their likes and dislikes, but
Sure.
I guess for you, I mean, what was the reason for you to say, this is not really quite my cup of tea?
It's a lot to juggle as a dungeon master, as a GM. I feel like there's a lot of people like to say fifth edition is like the easiest version of D&D there ever was, and I don't think that's true. I think 0e probably is.
Yeah.
For those little 310 books are probably the easiest game you could ever run, in my opinion, once you like parse out the Gygaxian in them. But there's just a lot of moving parts in 5e, and it was just I wasn't having fun anymore. And like you, like I don't have I think 5e, like if you use the three core rule books from 2014, you can have serviceable fun in that game. But it's just I would play in a 5e game. I just don't really have a desire to run it anymore, I guess. So I just sort of fell out of love with it. And you know, 5e tries to harken back to a lot of AD&D and BX stuff, so I was sort of just like, well, why don't I just go learn to play those versions of the game instead of this version? You know, it's probably more to my taste.
Yeah, to me, for me, it kind of it emulates, it does a probably a pretty good job of emulating the very, very high fantasy
Yeah.
type of genre, where for me, that's not very appealing.
Yeah, I like a little more gritty, like sword and sorcery style, you know, where magic is a little more underpowered and rare. And in 5e, yeah, every class is magical in some respect. And I get that people kind of like that. It's just not to my taste personally. Like I said, I'd play in a 5e game. If one of my friends came to me and said, "Hey, you want to play in my 5e game?" I'd be like, "Sure." But I don't really have an intention of running it ever again. So.
Yeah, and I think the thing is that, and I'm agree. I think I didn't care for 3.5. That's probably the only one I really would probably I have would probably say no to, but it depends who's running it. But in general, you're right. It is fun. It does what it does. And I'd probably be less inclined to run it, but I would definitely be more inclined to play it.
Yeah. But as for running games, I just find old school rules just be easier on the GM and the players still have fun. You know, if you're using Rule Cyclopedia and you are using Weapon Mastery, you know, you get sort of pseudo feat type stuff that is cool stuff for players to do and work towards and earn. But it's not, in my opinion, so ridiculously everyone's magical. So it still suits my taste. And there's still something there for the players as well. You know, like they can they can still have something to build off of and have fun with. But it's not this crazy, again, a bajillion moving parts that the DM has to keep track of that I feel 5e kind of struggles with as far as on the DM side.
I don't think necessarily the narrative has to fit by the edition, but one person was lamenting on a Discord about how she had this game going and they got to the big bad guy at the end. And as the culmination of multiple events, and this was the big point, and the characters fled. And it's like, well, in old school, I mean, that's typical. I mean, you would say either maybe we just better regroup later. Now we know we're facing Tiamat or whatever, or whatever. And I think what's interesting is, the idea is you play to find out what happens, where the other one is really wanting to kind of have a narrative goes along. Neither side is right or wrong, but I just thought it was interesting that she was then flummoxed because now what do I do? that the characters didn't die and the bad guy still left unchallenged.
Now that bad guy gets to do bad guy things still,
Right. I think that's just it. I kind of mentioned that, that just becomes part of the story, right? The story continues. Where I think with 5th edition, you culminate, that's the end of the story. Where here it's like, okay, now we got the bad guy doing his things. And now I guess we got to deal with us running.
Yeah. And, maybe the bad guy knows who the players are now. You know? And he's going to send some minions, some assassins or whatever after the players. And, the players poked the hornet's nest and now they got to deal with the consequences of that. And that's an adventure all to itself, in my opinion. That even in 5th edition, you could do that. I guess the thing I lament is that I guess in 5e, a lot of people, I've talked about this with some of my friends, and it seems like a lot of people, like I think it's a perfectly serviceable addition for a lot of people, but a lot of people, like they don't know things that are like in the DMG that are like, even in the 5e one, that are good advice they could use to make their game more suited to their tastes, they don't know it's there. They don't bother to look for it. And I think that contributes to some of it. Like some people just don't look in their books and see the cool stuff that's in there that they could draw from or the advice that's there. They sort of ignore it, or they just, like I said, they don't know it's there.
Well, to me, what's interesting about 5th edition is you really don't even need the DMG to run the game.
Yeah.
And it really comes across as really being the most superfluous of all the books. And there is good stuff. Like you said, there is some really good stuff in there. There's some very, very good stuff in there. But in the end, it's like whoever looks through their DMG, it's just there's, except for some treasure or whatever's in there. I can't remember what's in there anymore. But I remember thinking it's like, I didn't even need to buy this.
Yeah, especially if you're experienced, I guess. If you're like an older gamer who's going to try out 5e, you probably don't need that DMG, especially if you have like the 1e DMG, which is, I think the 1st edition DMG is like the greatest DMG that's ever been written. Like even if you're running 5e, you could get the 1st edition AD&D book. And if you can parse out the quote High Gygaxian, there's good stuff in there for you to draw from.
Oh yeah. In fact, I do a zine called Gary's Appendix. And so that's the inspiration is because it's just a whole sorts of crazy. I mean, you flip through it. It's just like, we're talking about gemstones or talking about building a castle or you're talking about diseases and parasites. It's just like, you can just flip through this and read all sorts of just odds and ends that just seem to not really fit, but yet somehow there's a connective tissue that pulls it all together.
Yeah, and I guess to your point of like not needing the DMG, like within 1st edition, what's interesting, I get, it shows design choice here. And you can either, I get people not liking it or disliking it, but there's a lot of rules that are in the DMG that are not in the player's handbook. Like you can read the 1st edition player's handbook and you still don't know how to play Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. Right. You still need to read the DMG. Whereas with 5th edition, you can read the 5th edition PHB and you know how to play the game. All the little secret stuff that maybe in 1E would have been secret in the DMG for the DM to know. And, maybe that's part of it as well. I guess I would reorganize the books to make it more closer to that, but that's just my personal preference and liking older stuff than the way things are organized now, I guess.
Yeah, and I think probably most people have bought the sets, but I just thought it was just kind of interesting that they put them together in a way that you really didn't need to buy that third one.
But yeah, there's good stuff in there. The 5e Dungeon Masters, the dungeon generator is pretty good. I don't like that it doesn't have 45 degree angles for the dungeon generator. I think the 45 degree angles are cool, but nonetheless, it's still a good little dungeon generator that some people I don't even know it's there. You got cool optional rules for making the game more gritty and difficult. And, you know, a lot of people complain about 5e being too easy for players. Your 5e DMG has rules in there that make it harder. So,
well, the problem I had really, and for me where it failed, is the promise was they kind of gave rules, but it's just little bits like, well, you could adjust or just that, this or that, but you really don't know the effects. And once you start playing around, like say healing,
yeah,
what does that really do? You know, if you can only heal once a week or once a day, or, you know, you change around with the rests and the short rests. I mean, you can do that, but there really wasn't much guidance as far as what that means, as far as encounters, what that means, as far as lethality or how other aspects in the game. So, I mean, to me, it would be more interesting is, you know, limit the healing and limit the amount of times that people can recuperate. But what does that do to the game? I don't know.
That's the other issue with 5e is there's so many, all the subsystems are very much interconnected. And so, like, you have a butterfly effect. So if you've changed one thing, you might not realize that you've drastically affected something else down the line that, you know, drastically alters the game. Or, you know, you change healing and all of a sudden you've like nerfed a class and a player wants to do something, and all of a sudden something that would be a niche for that character class, like, it can't do anymore because you tinkered with this over here, you know. And with an old school, I don't feel like the subsystems are quite as interconnected like that. So you're able to, because there's less there in old school. So you can tinker with stuff in old school and you're not going to break the game, I think, as easily as in 5e, where everything is like this interconnected thing. And I get the interconnectedness. It makes the game more streamlined. It adds some mechanical depth that some modern players really like. But if you do dislike something, you do change something, and you oftentimes, like you said, don't know the effects that you're causing.
I think the reason they also did rejigger the characters the way they did is to keep people from feeling like chumps, because you could pick a class and all of a sudden it does nothing. You're going to feel like a chump. And so I think everything is balanced in a way. It's like before, like the wizard's the easiest one, you know, like old school, you know, when I played first edition, you know, you had darts and you had daggers. You'd go and throw and run away and throw and run away and throw and run away until eventually you kind of experience points that you could actually do something. Or now they say, you know, it's not fun playing that game. So they created cantrips where you can go pew, 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 and you can do 1d8 damage, just like the fighter shooting arrows, or, you know.
Yeah.
And so I get why they did it, but like you said, it's all mechanically. If you start nerfing one thing, you can have a ripple effect that you don't really foresee.
And it's compounded, like I said before, if you've not looked in your rule books and parsed out all the rules, right, like, you know, which I think a lot of people do. I see it all the time, you know, for better or worse. I see a lot of people that are proud of the fact, for instance, that like they don't read their books, or that they learn from watching, you know, an actual play. And you can have your opinion on what actual plays are or aren't, but I think that's, to me, kind of like, I'll preface it by saying I don't care what other people do at their table. Like, you want to play a certain way, I don't care. Like, it doesn't affect my game.
Right.
But I do think that if, you know, the authors put stuff in those books that is interesting, and they put it there for a purpose and a reason, and you're potentially doing a disservice to your game by not taking the time to really see what's there and the options that you really truly have as either a player or a DM, and seeing what you like and don't like. So yeah, at the end of the day, I don't care what you do at your table, but I try to encourage people, especially new people, like, you know, really, really stick your nose in that book and like find all that cool stuff in there and like own it.
Yeah, it's like there's a correlation to the board game Monopoly, which I, for a while, longest time, started thinking it was the worst game ever. Not ever, but a terrible game. But then I realized after listening to somebody or somebody talking about the most common thing that's not in the rules that people put in the rules is throwing that cash into the middle. And if you run on, if you land on, I forget which square, then you get all the cash in the middle. Well, the problem is that prolongs the game. And the very thing that everybody think is cool and it's fun, putting all that cash in the middle every time you pay a tax, you throw it in the middle with a chance of somebody like a lottery winning it, inadvertently just makes it a bad game. And it wasn't designed for that. And when you change the design, it takes something that wasn't broken and then breaks something that you don't foresee just for what everybody thinks is fun, but in the end gives them less fun.
Yeah. And I see that a lot in 5e. You know, people... Like old school combat's very like lean and mean, you know, it's very like very fast, which is what I like. But I see in 5e combat, like when I ran games, there would be a session where most of the session is just a single combat, you know, and I didn't enjoy that very much. We're like, let's show up and let's have like this big old long combat. I know some people do like that, but for me, like I like my BX games and my AD&D games and running white box stuff because, you know, I like getting to multiple combats. I like them getting in multiple rooms in the dungeon and like seeing and experiencing multiple things, monsters or traps or things like that along the way, and not having that, you know, as adults, we don't have a whole lot of time with all the adulting that we got to do. Having all that time eaten up by a single combat and then, oh, all right, guys, peace out, you know, see you next week. So, you know, And I feel like 5e is very susceptible to like when you're changing rules. It's kind of like your Monopoly example where you end up sort of slogging the game down. It's an easy game to kind of add to make it a slog as opposed to older editions.
Right. You're probably not going to make it more efficient. Yeah. And it's kind of interesting because I was even thinking about, I know some people, I don't necessarily play as much old school games as I like to or run them, but I know one group they like doing was called shield sundering, where as a fighter can, instead of taking the hit, can just choose to have their shield broken. Mm. And it kind of gives them a free hit. And I started thinking, well, that does disproportionately benefit the fighter. But then I started thinking about it. It's like, but the in those systems, the magic user is behind the fighter. And it's really helping the party. It's not really like making one person shine, another person not shine, as it would be fifth edition.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you can add rules easily. You're saying they probably have, and that's a good example of where there probably less amount of stack up with things going wrong. And especially since characters are already pretty squishy.
Yeah. You do something like Shield Sundering and BX or Zero-E. And, you know, oh, you added like maybe an extra round of combat to the combat, you know.
Right.
You don't know what you're doing in 5e. You don't know how long you've prolonged it in 5e because there's so much more mechanical depth to that combat system.
And you only have 5 hit points. So it's like, okay, you know, the next hit, you're still always 1 hit away from dying. It's
rolling up a new character. Time to start over.
Yeah, so that's cool. So let me get my door. My dogs for some reason are being a little noisy.
All good.
Apparently they're protecting me from a pedestrian walking their small poodle. So apparently that's a threat. I can't understand what they determine are threats and when things they don't determine as threats. So like, a little girl walking around with a backpack in front of our house will bark. Other times it could be somebody walking a bunch of dogs. Not a word. I don't know.
Well, they know something you don't. Maybe I don't know.
they may be right. You know what? What if all these things is there actually are, you know, terrible, horrible things that we're unable to see that are posing as these, and in the end we find out they've actually saved us from being murdered, massacred by these people we thought were safe.
Yeah, a little girl is a skinwalker or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So you. So that I can't, I'm terrible about pronunciation. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
It's all good.
So the, it's a white box role playing in the Aztec Empire. And how do you pronounce that again?
Makuahitl.
Makuahitl. Makuahitl. Makuahitl. Okay.
That's a Nahuatl word. That's like the sword that the Aztec warriors would use, which was like a wooden club. And then they'd, with pine resin, they'd embed like a prismatic obsidian blades along the edge. So
I will tell you, nothing really creeped me out as much as when I was somewhere in a museum and I realized these people were fighting semi-naked with wooden weapons with things embedded in them. And there's something about that I find horrifying.
Yeah, it's horrifying. It's terrifying.
Horrifying. Raggedy, I mean, sharp cuts, with nothing to protect you, just skin. Oh my goodness.
They had two-handed Makuahitls, and the Spanish, when they arrived, noted that like not only would these Makuahitls decapitate men, but they would charge in with their horses, and the Aztec warriors would lop off the heads of their horses with these obsidian edged weapons. They're absolutely terrifying weapons. You don't want to get hit with one.
Like, you'll have a bad day.
Yeah, very bad day.
Yeah, I mean, it was medicine back then, I'm sure they were able to deal with certain things, but my goodness, like, ooh.
And it's interesting, though, because contrasted with the idea that for an Aztec warrior, killing an opponent was considered often a waste.
Yeah.
They would often try and take them back alive because you needed slaves, he needed sacrifice victims to fuel the sun. So, you know, it's these horrible weapons, but then they also would like, they really didn't try and kill each other at the same time too. Like, you would advance your station in society if you could bring back a bunch of prisoners from a flower war or from a, you know, a regular war as well, for regular conflict. So that was a way for you to advance yourself in society. And so it is an interesting little like balance and to me with the weapon. It's kind of why I named the game after it. Well, partly because the original name was actually Obsidian and Blood. And then I realized that was taken as a novel series and it wasn't trademarked or anything because it was a small little indie author, but being a small little indie creator myself, I wanted to be respectful of them. And so I changed the name. I was like, you got your thing. I don't want to mess with that. So I changed the name to Makuahitl, but that's probably why I picked the name though too, because it's just I don't know, it's an interesting weapon and there's a lot of interesting context behind it, in my opinion.
Well, I think it is, it's fairly iconic.
Yes, yeah, it's when you think of warriors, you always see them wielding, as Mesoamerican warriors, even the Mayans obviously had similar weapons, and the Incas as well. You know, you think of that, you think of the Makuahitl. So it is like the long sword of the Mesoamerican culture, I guess. You know, when we think of knights, we think of long swords. When we think of these Aztec, we think of a jaguar warrior, we think of him with a sword, with a Makuahitl and a shield. So
yeah, pretty terrifying. So the art is phenomenal. At least all the art pieces presented in the Kickstarter.
Oh, thank you. I did most of it myself.
Yeah, I saw that you were the artist, so that helps cut down the art costs.
Yeah, I'm the sole person behind the whole thing. So
you couldn't afford yourself otherwise.
I feel blessed that I'm able to like that I like writing games and that I can do the art myself. There's a lot of creators out there that are in similar shoes to me, and art is always the greatest barrier to getting their idea out there, you know. And art is expensive, you know. If you want to pay for an artist, they're expensive. And I will be honest, a lot of us artists are sort of flaky jerks sometimes. So we're expensive and flaky. So I feel blessed that I can kind of rely on just myself. And if I fail, it's just my fault.
Yeah, you're right. In fact, I even I just recently experienced a little flakiness myself. So, but it's like, I don't understand. It's like, that's okay. It is what it is. But I think that's true for probably anything you're involved in, where you start depending on other people. And so what's interesting about, so you chose the dark red and black is on white paper, being the choice, mm-hmm. which to me is interesting for a number of reasons. So this reminds me of what I just picked up. It kind of makes me think in some ways of that same similar palette choice with Outlaw Silver Raiders.
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, I would recommend picking it up. It's a box set and it is okay. absolutely beautiful. It's medieval, but it's set up like, I guess it would be, if you could imagine OSC with a little bit of Morkborg and maybe a little bit of James Raji's Europe kind of mixed okay. together.
So but, kind of clear, concise rules with cool layout and an edgy setting.
Yeah. In fact, the magic rules are, he basically, not basically, the magic user is, every spell basically is condensed to a mechanic. There's three mechanics and it's all on one page. So,
oh, cool.
But anyway, the art is not the same, but the choice of that splash of red, with a black illustrations makes it very, I find it hard to turn it down. So it's absolutely beautiful choice.
Yeah, thank you. I thought, you know, Obsidian is oftentimes black, so I thought like black, and then obviously red blood was a big component of Aztec society, you know, and Mesoamerican society blood was very important, so it just seemed to fit. I know it is a very used and a very attractive, it's attractive, but a very like kind of cliche color scheme, but I don't care. I liked it and I thought it fit the setting.
There's a Daredevil series I was reading. I got it Marvel Unlimited, so I can't remember which one it was, but they would do Daredevil. And was there, maybe I'm getting confused, but anyway, they would have red in there, just, and it was just as a black and white comic with red in it, and I just thought that was just absolutely fantastic.
It's very visceral, and it's sort of, when you want to highlight something, you just splash that red on there and it's like boom, you know, this is important. So
but by doing so, you're doing offset printing, so that changes that. So that's the other thing. Well, I guess I'll go back around. I was going to say you just increase your costs considerably because now it's a color, but you're doing offset press. So it might be a little different, but once you put a color on there, it's now a colored book.
Yeah, I'm going to do it. I am going to put it on Lulu and DriveThruRPG. I do have a print on demand option. And it will be like slightly more expensive on DriveThruRPG, but not terribly much. Not like I would be able to get away on DriveThruRPG with like the standard color, which is a little cheaper than the premium color on DriveThruRPG, which gets quite a bit more expensive because you know you want that premium color, so you get those premium, you get that nice vivid detail. But when it's just like very graphical, like what I'm doing in this, I think it will still be, even on print on demand, it'll still look good, but it won't be I guess I'll see when I get proofs in, but it'll look good. It'll look good still. I think, I hope. I have some experience with it in the past, and it seems to look okay.
Yeah, because I looked at doing color. I think it adds like 40% or 30%, 50%, somewhere around there to the cost over just a black and white book.
Yeah, and most of my previous books, like I have Atomic Punk, which is sort of like BX and OD&D and Traveler sort of smushed together into a game. I did that one black and white, and the print cost is a lot lower, so I was able to, like, I can sell that book for pretty cheap and affordable for a lot of people. But I did a full color game prior to this called Cowpunchers, which is like a cowboy dice pool game, and that one was like, I went color because I was a little ambitious, and it did like up the price. So unfortunately, that book, for me to like even get a moderate profit at all to recoup any loss or costs or anything like that, like, it makes the book much more expensive than just a black and white book. But that one has like full color illustrations in it and everything. So,
well, right. Well, the thing is even with this, if you were to go from just red to full color illustrations and backgrounds and throughout the book, it doesn't change the price of the book. It just, the color, once you hit color, but it's just one piece of color on one page, it doesn't matter, or it's full color throughout, it's still now a color book and you're paying that color price.
Yeah, if it's full color, then you probably want to go to the premium on either of them. And that's what really pumps up the price like significantly. Because if you print, if you print like these hyper detailed colored illustrations on like, you know, the cheaper paper, it's not going to look good. You know, it's people are going to buy your book and be like, yeah, you know, and I don't want that. But I'm going to see how it goes. Like, I have the print on demand Rule Cyclopedia and Gamma World first edition, and those have like color stuff in them. And the book was relatively affordable still for me to purchase it.
Yeah.
And the color printing in it, it's very similar. Like Gamma World just has like some blue maps. And then, you know, the Rule Cyclopedia just has those accents of green in it. And it still looks okay. It still looks pretty good in those books. Like I'm happy with the way those look. So that's kind of why I was like, I'm going to go with red, even for print on demand and like kind of eat the cost a little bit. But I think for a visual presentation, it'll be worth it. So I don't know. Well, I think books are kind of an experience too. So I want it to be like a, you know, a full experience still, even on print on demand.
But you're doing a hardcover offset book as well.
Yep. I'm getting them, those printed in Lithuania. There's a Lithuanian, they gave me the best price. I tried to get them printed in the United States, but they gave me the best price, and some American printers didn't even want to talk to me. I was too small, but these,
you
know, guys,
now that you mentioned that, somebody reached out to me. I was going to get back with them, but I was thinking that it would only be good if I was to print or ship to Europe, but you're saying even shipping to the US, it's actually a good deal.
Yeah, so I found an importer that gave me a pretty fair price, and the print itself, the Lithuanian printer gave me a good price. And this printing company, I've had a friend. Are you familiar with Greg from Chronicles of Iris? I don't know if you've interacted with him at all.
No.
He's a good guy. He has his Chronicles of Iris books. They're like these 5e books. Setting book. They're actually really good. You know, of course, third party does 5e better than and Wizards does, but his books look really good. I've seen them, and they look really nice, and he recommended this printer to me, and they gave me a really good price on the offset print. And it's going to be, you know, this is with a little, you know, ribbon in the book, because I love the ribbon in the book. And this will be black cover. It'll be kind of like what's behind me here with the Aztec calendar. I'm going to have like embossed, like gold, not gold, red foiling like this. So it'll be black and red on the cover with like imprinted foiling. So hopefully it'll look really nice, and people will feel like their pledges are worth it.
Well, what I'll say is, I don't know, for $32 for a hardcover book with the foil and the ribbon is a deal.
Yeah.
There is no reason why, unless you're really, really short on funds, to not be picking this up for $32 for a hardbound book, foil embossed. I don't know if it's embossed, but foil and ribbon and beautiful artwork throughout. I mean, you can't lose.
It'll be on decent paper. It's not going to be like cheap, probably print on demand paper, but it's going to be like, you know, I think I said 80 pound. Don't quote me on that. I don't remember. This has all been kind of a blur to me, but it'll be on nice paper. And yeah, obviously the offset print is going to look a lot crisper than a print on demand print. So for all the art and everything.
So I'm guessing, since you're looking at offset printing, you're planning on getting this distributed. Is that what you're looking at?
I'm using a fulfillment company, because I don't want to do the shipping myself. So I'm going to use a fulfillment company. I found a really good fulfillment company. They gave me another very good deal on fulfillment. So they'll ship the books out for me, and they'll actually store the books for me for a monthly fee. And so I can take advantage of their lower shipping rates that I won't, even if I got like a stamps.com account or something like that, I wouldn't have access to.
You don't have to tell me your rates, but you mind telling you're using for fulfillment?
Sure. Flying Cloud Fulfillment is the company.
Okay.
So they do a lot of RPGs and board games stuff that they like help with distribution and whatnot. So they can store the books for you, and they'll ship the books out for me. So I could put whatever's left over from the amount that I order for the Kickstarter when it's done. I'll be able to obviously list the book on my website and then still sell these nice offset prints, whatever's left, little onesie twosies after the fact. So if you miss the Kickstarter and, you know, funds are tight, you might still get a chance after, depending on how things go. So on how many are left, based on what I'm going to order. So, which at the moment is only 500 of the hardcover. I'll get more obviously if it more than 500 people back
so,
that.
Okay. But, so yeah, maybe we talk prices later if you're not comfortable, but so you're doing an offset press for only 500 books.
Yeah. They gave me a price for 500. This is what I'm saying. This is a good printers. I'm glad my friend Greg turned me on to them. So
yeah, because I was looking, in fact, I was just looking at hard covers, black and white, 8.5 by 11. This is for 100, for 100. So nothing was changing much by incrementally from this. So I'd do 500 or whatever the price per book was. But 8.5 by 11 was $9.63. Digest size was $6.09. A5 was $9.09. A4 is $12.49. And also comic book size is $12.49. So really your cheapest bet is to go with an 8.5 by 11 or with a digest. But that was per book. And that's what that was coming to. So I'm about to check out. The nice thing is it's pretty quick turnaround and shipping, but the downside is, maybe we can talk about the companies to see if offset for, it might be worthwhile doing it for some other books I'm be doing.
Yeah. Mockwheatle is going to be digest size. I like digest size. I feel like it's a fun, good size for at the table. And this is a white box thing, and those three little tan books were of a similar size, you know. So I kind of wanted to harken back to that.
Yeah, and I think I do too. I think the thing is, and I agree about the digest size. The old school sense, you're not trying to mimic that size, but you know, the old school essentials, you know, being the A5, a person may or may not want to follow that. Because my zine I do is an A5, mm-hmm. but I don't have any hardbacks of A5, but I'm looking at doing some other products, but I'm going to probably want to match probably the size that they're using. But I want to do comic book size. So I find that format, that ratio looks really nice. And I did that for one of my projects, but looking at this is the most expensive option.
It's for this company. It's rough. I guess I hope people listening and watching kind of see, like, it's a struggle being a creator in this. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things you're balancing and struggling with that you gotta take into consideration, you know, so you don't end up in the hole.
Yes, it can happen really quick. It can happen really, really quick if you're not careful. And that's why, you know, and for me, at least this company, you know, when I was looking at trying to bump up quantities to get to the offset press, because this was not offset press prices, it was over like, I think you had to get about 5,000 before it would switch over to offset press. So yeah, I'm gonna have to look. I'm gonna check out that email and see if I can find who that was, because that may be worthwhile for certain projects. But yeah, when I saw you doing offset press, I thought you were ordering like 3,000 of these. I'm like, good night. You're gonna that maybe had people who were wanting to sell these, you know, in their stores and such.
No, I wish. I mean, that'd be a dream someday. But I don't think I'm at that point yet. I do think that with a quantity of like 500, though, it does add a little bit of exclusivity to it, and it does make it feel like a collector's item, you know, because once I do this, like, of course, the pod will always be out there. I'm going to put the pod up, and you can get your nice little print on demand book that you can abuse at the table. But if you want like the nicer hardcover version, like that's going to be very limited in supply. And I think some people kind of like that, you know, and I want to be to me that's. That's cool. Like I backed Tawnisborg, for example. I really like that the Lost Dungeon of Tawnisborg, really beautiful book. And, you know, some of those books now, the first printing, they go for like 500, you know, like they're just insane. Cause Griff over there at a Fellowship of the Thing didn't print a whole lot, you know, right. And he does these limited print runs. And I'm not sure if Tanis Bork's probably ever going to come back. I think this last one I backed when I got on board, I think it might've been the last that he wants to move on to other books, you know, and do other things. So, you know, that might be it. The trade paperback will be available, but you know, you want that nice, gold foiled, you know, cover, with a ribbon, you know, that might be done. You're going to have to get that secondhand market. But for the people that got it, you know, that's special. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm, there's a project I'm working on. I may look at, I'm thinking about maybe just doing a hardcover only, and maybe I'll do just a special limited edition run as well. I did that with Fame of the Fly God, where I did, because I didn't think anybody's going to buy the hardcover, which was actually wrong. More people bought the hardcover than the softcover, but I was only going to print that one once. So it's about done. As far as the copies on hand. So, but people do. And so, you know, it's actually that's beautiful. So what have you done to the rules for, let me see if I can do this now. It's a I'm messing up already. Makuhito.
Got it. That's good.
Makuhito.
Yeah. So what have I done? So, you know, it's typical white box rules. So you're rolling pretty much just a D20 and D6s to kind of harken back to like pre-supplement one Greyhawk. D&D. Greyhawk, I really love that pre-supplement one game. I think it's a really neat game. So and it's like an infinitely hackable game. Like almost, it's a feature, not a bug of that edition. So what I did is there's custom, obviously, classes that are of a Mesoamerican Aztec flavor. You can be an Eagle Warrior, Jaguar Warrior, Nohali or Nagual, which is like a shape-shifting shamanistic priest sorcerer. You could be a Pochteca, which is like a merchant class. He's kind of like your face class. He gives you bonuses for reaction rolls and other sort of social type stuff. And then I have two sort of classes that are gate kept. They're like very elite warrior classes. There's the Atomi mercenaries, which were very distinguished. They were like natives of the Valley of Mexico even before the Aztecs arrived in the valley. And they became mercenaries for a lot of the Aztecs and gained a lot of trust and were some of the most valuable warriors. So you can be an Atomi mercenary, and those guys, you know, you got to have like I think it's a strength of 15 and dexterity of like 12. So you got to get some good ability score rolls on 3d6 in order to get that class. And the same goes with the Shorn one, which is these are like, they're like the Jaguar class or like the fighter class, but kind of they're beefed up a little bit. But I try to balance it by, again, having those classes kind of gatekept by getting good rolls on your ability scores. So that's one of the first things. Second thing is obviously weapons are a little different. Aztec weapons were interesting in that, as we talked about, they're very devastating and deadly, but those prismatic obsidian edges would sometimes break off or fall out and you'd have to replace them. So maintaining your weapons is a little extra thing I added. The XP system is completely different from traditional white box. Instead of experience points, I have status points, and status points function as both of like a currency in the game world, because that was a big struggle for me, because obviously classic D&D is about XP for gold. You're going into a dungeon. You're trying to find gold. You're bringing it back out to town. Cool. You gained a level. You can't really do that with this Aztec setting. The goal of an Aztec warrior was to go out and get prisoners, or to go out and like raid a enemy stronghold, or to win a battle, you know, or to defend his city state. And so like I had to do a different XP system so that the status point values are a little closer to 5e, but I know that might irk some people. So they're smaller, but it's balanced out by the fact that your upkeep, and if you want to employ hirelings or followers or anything like that, is also spent with status points. And when you spend your status points to level up, it's gone. It resets to zero, and you have a much larger like gap of points that you have to earn in order to get to the next level. So because the other problem I had was the Aztecs, their currency wasn't gold coins. They didn't have gold coins.
Right.
They had a quachtli, which was like cloth, lengths of cloth, like standard lengths of cloth. They had cocoa beans. They had these things called ho money, which were like little, they were sort of like coins, but they were like little copper, they look like little axe heads, and those were like their coins. And maize and other things like that. It was obviously like a barter society. So like, how do you go into it doesn't have the same feel. It's like, oh, you found some gold and silver and gems, like in classic D&D. It's not like, oh, you found some maize, some cocoa beans, and some cloth. Like, to me, that's just not as exciting.
Yeah.
So there is treasure, but treasure is just sort of abstracted as like you found like 100 status points of treasure. And this could be a mix of cocoa beans. This could be a mix of precious metals. This could be a mix of everything. And it's 1 pound per status point. You find 100 pound, you find 100 status point loot that you raided from a village, an enemy tribe village. That's 100 pounds that you got to carry back to your city state. The advancement system also uses taking prisoners. So obviously you want to try and get prisoners for sacrifice or slavery. I don't shy away from Aztec society in any way. Like I wanted to be true to who they were as a culture and as a people. So if you are able to capture an opponent, you get 5 times their value. So normally if you kill them, you know, oh, they're worth 50. They're worth 50 status points, you know, if you kill them in battle. If you knock them out and bring them back alive, that's 250. So you're going to get a lot more points if you start bringing back followers or bringing back prisoners alive. Conversely, prisoners go towards your charisma score of number of followers. So you have to start managing like how many followers do I have, how many hirelings do I have, with how many prisoners do I have, because I got to manage all these people. And the last thing I'll say about it that makes it kind of fun and playtesting all summer is when you play traditional D&D, you're generally not worried about the loot that you find in a dungeon running away from you. But in Makuhitl, you capture prisoners, they're going to want to try and escape and get away from you. So now your treasure, your XP, your status point treasure is trying to run away from you at any chance it can get. So that definitely adds like a different dynamic when players are trying to travel back from like a battle or from a raid or from something like that. You know, they have to manage their hirelings and their prisoners as well.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because the very thing that gives you that is also the thing that's also creating your biggest headaches or some of your biggest headaches.
Yeah, I mean, and gold and old school D&D does that as well. You know, you're always, it's a resource game, right? So you're managing encumbrance, and you have encumbrance in this as well, of course. But there's an extra layer of like prisoners and things like that that you have to.
Well, I think you've taken that whole idea of, well, I can't remember what it's called, but basically a certain level where fighters get a keep, wizards get a tower, but you've made it much earlier. and made it both the means of getting what you want, but also, which I think is always fun, is creating complications for characters. That's, it's a complication that you aren't necessarily foisting on them. They really want that complication because they want the XP.
Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting, like in our playtests, you know, my players, the playtesters, I ran the game right before the Triple City Alliance of the Aztec Empire. So Tenochtitlan had just been founded. It's the reign of the first emperor, and it's like in the first year of his reign. And so the city state of Texcoco is not an ally yet. They were not part of the Triple City Alliance yet. And So my players have had started quite a big grudge with Texcoco and the Texcocans across the across Lake Texcoco. So Tenochtitlan is like over here and Texcoco is like up here. And so my players, after a few sessions, they had accumulated some status points and they're like, and it was cool because it worked the way I wanted it to. It was like, do we purchase our level or do we purchase a war canoe and try and go raid Texcoco? You know, what do we do? If we purchase, because if we purchase a level, we're going to have to travel around the lake to get to Texcoco and raid them. If we kind of hold off on leveling and get a canoe, we'll get there a lot quicker. And then maybe we can use the canoe to bring back more loot or prisoners. You're bringing stuff.
Capitalism into the.
So, it's good though, because I have those smaller, closer to 5e level progressions, but since the XP currency, the status points are used for both material goods and for leveling, it makes them make choices and it actually slows down leveling. So it still feels like they're progressing at an old school rate. You know, it's not like every other session, you know, they're gaining a level, which I feel like sometimes can happen in 5e, for example, you know, where at least the first few levels, the players like really breeze through that. And with an old school, like it can be kind of a slog, not a slog. It can last a lot longer in old school than it does in 5e in those first like 4 to 5 levels, you know? And so the math kind of worked out for me, I think, that it still levels slowly enough to where it doesn't feel like you're just rushing through the first few levels, you know, which is good. I'm glad it worked out.
Well, it sounds like you are implementing a lot of really novel, and maybe they're not novel, but they seem novel to me, a lot of novel mechanics as core mechanics to pretty much this old system. So, which to me is always exciting.
Well, that's why I love White Box. That's why I love those little 10 books, because like there are so many holes in that original book that there's a lot of room there's a lot of things that are not explained. You know, I know Gary says as many rules as possible were covered in these three little books, but you know, there's a lot of stuff where there's a lot of referee interpretation or you know what I mean, like there's a lot of stuff where like this isn't covered and I gotta make a ruling.
But, yeah, but when he wrote it, I mean, there was a lot less people playing and it was pretty much a wargaming crowd. They probably weren't,
yeah,
it was probably most of the questions or thoughts were along a certain path or a certain vector, where now it's people are coming from different areas of interests, that those vectors can come from multiple ways. It becomes harder.
I just find it like it's I don't know what it is. There's just something special about that rule set that I like, that just feels like it's been a lot of fun to work with and make this in. Because I tried to make this with like AD&D under the hood, and I tried to make it with BX under the hood even. And VX is a little closer, but it still didn't feel right. And then once I started toying with, you know, using 0E under the hood and then building on top of that, it just immediately felt like it clicked. I can't describe it.
The thing is too, is, you know, what you presented, you know, is a mechanic, and on that mechanic is a skin, but that skin could be changed to whatever. If you say, you know what, I think this is a bit icky, you could be doing cattle raids, you know, I mean, whatever. I mean, it doesn't have to be people. I mean, that could be, you know, a lot of different things that become difficult to manage. And then you have to hire all these other people in order to make these things work out, that, you know, it would carry over.
Yeah, and I guess that's what it is too. I kind of see in older editions, it's more wargamey roots. You know, you kind of see it in AD&D. You know, when you see like the number of appearing, and you're like, oh crap, I ran into 200 orcs. This is great. there's just an orc war band just running through this hex right now. This is awesome. You know, but you know, I like that part of it. That's something that's lost today in modern versions and iterations of the game. And I wanted it to feel like my players were at war when I was running this game. Like they're constantly at war. It's like, this is a warrior society. This is a warrior culture. This is an empire. And I want the players to feel like they're in the midst of a war all the time.
But I guess the thing too is, if it's in the character's best interest to try and take prisoners, conversely, it's, or maybe not conversely, but on the other side, it's their opponent's best interest mm-hmm. to capture the players. So, you know, it there probably is a means of saying, okay, I give up. It's you know, this is pointless, and try and figure out a way of escaping later on.
Mm-hmm. And it yes, it's true. One other mechanic that I've added to character creation too is the Aztecs were obviously very much into their sacred calendars, alignment of stars, and they had a whole like 20 sign zodiac thing. And so I've implemented that into character creation. You roll 2d20s to determine what your character's zodiac sign is, and then you roll that also determines what day they're on, because they believe in certain lucky and unlucky days.
Yeah.
And so these things provide they can be really bad for your character at character creation, which I would encourage people to still play with a character, for instance, that is born on an unlucky day and has a curse or some kind of handicap to their character. I think it could still be interesting and fun to play. And I try to make the handicaps gameable still, questable, or like one of them is like your family is haunted by like a supernatural force, and it gives the GM, it gives the referee an opportunity and the player to be like, let's go on a quest to deal with this problem that's like plaguing my character's family, you know.
But it would be kind of cool is if it plagues the people around the character.
Some of it does. Some of the stuff, like you might be born on a day where people of that sign are considered to be scoundrels and just not good people. Nobody trusts you. So therefore, like reaction roles and other, you're in a group of players and maybe they have great stuff, but like you're considered not trustworthy. You're considered because of your sign, you're considered like a kind of a scumbag, even though you might not be, but that's right. that's just the perception that people have about you. And you got to live with that now.
And no matter what you do, even how noble and how good your tents are, it will always be seen through the lens that you're somehow self-motivated.
Oh, well, he's that sign. So, you know, doesn't.
Well, he's giving money to the poor, but he's only doing this in order to gain favor by somebody else. He really doesn't like the poor.
Yeah.
Or whatever it may be. Yeah.
Or he gave to the temple, like he doesn't really believe in the gods. He's probably just he's a heretic or something, you know. Like,
yeah, was even when he gave him good stuff, maybe he was just faking it.
Yeah. So I try to add stuff like that. So you do roll on like a table for the 20 zodiac signs, and then they had a 260-day calendar. So there was like 13, they're called tresenias, they're called phases, and there's 13 of them. And so you roll for like one of these phases and you end up with a bad day. You might end up with a bad day. You might end up with a good day, a good sign. So that's implemented in there. I don't remember where I was going with this, but I think it was something with, you know, I wanted to mention that I added zodiac signs into character.
Well, because I think what that allows for is a justification that ties into the setting to provide an interesting background and continuing narrative for the characters.
Mm-hmm. One fun thing you can do too is, there's a website, I linked to it in the PDF in the book, called like aztecalendar.com, I believe. And you can type in your birthday. You can look up what your sign would be. And you could use, if you wanted to, you could use a sign that you're born under and have that be your character's sign. I think that could be fun. So, you know, that you could just, instead of rolling, just like, what's my birthday? I look it up. Oh, that's what it is. Okay, I'm this sign. I'm going to have these penalties for my character. I was on this day, so I'm going to roll for whatever unlucky thing for that day or lucky thing for that day is. So, I don't know, just throwing that out there too. That could be fun.
Well, and I think what's also somewhat interesting, and like a friend of mine brings up about these older style games, is for the most part, the stats you roll don't matter because you have to usually roll very high to get any sort of plus, and even then it's not very big. And so, and I think also with these games is they're tend to be, combat tends to be lethal. So probably the people who are less engaged in combat are going to be people that survive most often.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes you can have a character that's kind of messed up with only 2 hit points, and they may live much longer and be much more successful than the person who, you know, 18 strength and full hit points. And and things aren't so good for them when they get hit by an axe the first day out.
Yeah, and you know the best you're gonna get in Makuhitl is a +1 on your attacks. Like as far as from your from your strength score, you know, yeah. I tried to keep it within that obviously like white box OD&D style where I like those smaller, I like those smaller, the tighter math, the smaller modifiers because because things are so limited in that respect, it really leans into player skill and player strategy and player tactics. Like you have to be a good player to make this character work. And I've really enjoyed watching my players during the play test really come up with creative solutions to problems that they're presented with and overcome them with like creative player engagement with the setting and the situation that's at hand.
Right. You have to be more cautious. You just don't. Yeah. I played a 5e games. It's the Lost Mines of Phandelver. Uh-huh. And there was a keep and there was this lich that was neutral to the whole thing. He just wanted to be left alone. And there's a door and they knocked on the door and he basically gave no indication that he was a bad guy, even though there's a bunch of bad guys, and just told him to leave him alone. So they kick open the door and decide to, you know, do their nonsense. It's time stop and whatever spell. And, you know, and he's like all upset, just like expecting every room to be, you know, you combat what's in there and it's all appropriate to the, to your hit points and level. But, you know, in older school games, there's no assumption, you know, you better be careful what you're going to do. And I think that those lower amounts, you say you want to create an advantage for your character. You don't want to just go in there and roll dice because it's may not wind out very good for you.
I view a lot of old school gaming as like a lot of negotiation between the player and the referee. The player is really trying to negotiate like the best situation they could possibly get. And then a roll is called for when it's like, I'm not sure, you know, let's roll to see what that would be. That's kind of how I run my games. Cause I really like to, hear my players like, I like to sit back, you know, and listen to them discuss their situation and like how are you going to solve this problem? Like in our playtest, like recently, because they've been having this ongoing feud with Tishkoko, because my players burned down the markets of Tishkoko and they captured a merchant and his guards and brought them back for sacrifice. They also robbed another merchant of very expensive goods and cloths and cocoa beans and stuff like that and brought it back to Tenochtitlan. So the Tishkokans were very upset. So they started sending a force of like 1,500 warriors around the lake to do battle with Tenochtitlan. And so this is like 1,000 to 1,500 enemy warriors, and it's my players against them. And the Nohali character, he has shapeshifting ability. He's like, well, I'm going to wait till the evening. I'm going to shapeshift into an owl and try and like spy on the camp. So he goes and does that. You know, and then the players, they start thinking like one of the backgrounds you can get based on your lucky day thing is you get to be your family can have like a basket weaving business or something like that, or a pottery business that produces a small trickle of status points and income for you. And so one of my players had that and he's like, well, we can buy pine resin, which was used as like a fuel for fire, you know, my family owns this like basket weaving business. Can I like get my family to give me a bunch of baskets and we put this pine resin in it and we're just going to light the forest on fire around this like army and cause chaos. And like, that's what they did. And they were able to like this small group of four players, like routed this whole, you know, 1,000 person army by using their magical abilities to spy on their camp, kind of figure where stuff was. And, you know, I'm rolling to make sure that like, maybe they might see the owl. You know, right. maybe they might see all this stuff. They got lucky and they were able to, there was some combat involved. They almost got caught, but you know, they just burned the woods down and caused chaos at their camp and were able to rout them and get them to retreat and regroup. So, you know, I like that kind of stuff. That's the kind of stuff that you don't see in a lot of modern games, but you'd see it in old school. And I think these older editions, and that's what I'm trying to do with Makuhitl, like, they create those kinds of situations that are like memorable to the players. Like they're going to remember, my players are going to remember, hey, remember that time we lit a whole forest on fire and routed an entire army, you know, like that's, they're going to remember that forever, you know? And I think that's cool.
Yeah, that is. The question is, I mean, most of the gamers, I would say, in the US are probably familiar with pseudo medieval Europe and also with, you know, let's say a little bit of Greece and a little bit of Egypt. And I don't know that probably most of us have like a very, anything more than a very shallow understanding of stuff in Mexico or South America. So I guess the question is like, how much, I'm assuming there's probably a fair amount of information in the books to guide those of us who are less familiar.
Sure. Yeah. So let me look at the PDF here. Because the PDF at the moment is about 173 pages of content. And the biggest chapter is chapter 7, which is the setting and running the game. And I pretty much go through like everything. So like engaging with a setting, you get like a history of the Chichimec people and the Aztec people as they entered into, as they left Aztlan, which is their like mystical ancestral homeland because the gods told them to leave. And as they left the seven sacred caves and entered the Valley of Mexico, I give you the creation myths in here. So you can kind of see like, I feel like creation myths are really important. You oftentimes do that when you're building your own setting. I feel like you want to figure out a creation myth or draw from a real world creation myth, because that kind of that sets the tone for what your society is going to be. So and it definitely does so with the Aztec people and their religion. So I cover that. I go through, so the creation of the universe, so the legend of the five suns. There's different suns that us currently, we're in the fifth sun, they would say. But there was four previous suns prior to that. I go through like the sacred calendar, different types of human sacrifice. I list as many Aztec gods as I possibly could and their like what they were gods of. Some afterlife stuff, Aztec society, so things like social structure, Aztec law. I give you a timeline of events, Aztec warrior culture, like what was the mentality of their warriors, what were they thinking, how did they field their armies, you know, how did their armies march through the field and what was their tactics. I cover a little bit of that. The enemies of the Aztec, what were the opposing tribes that resisted them or were often in conflict with them or rebelled against them. And then I give you like a ton of maps, a bunch of hex maps of Mexico, which you can see some of them on the Kickstarter page. So I try to give you like as much stuff as possible to sort of feel like if you read the book and you read chapter 7, you're going to feel confident enough to where you know enough to run the setting. I think I gave enough to where you have more than the basics, I think, in order to competently run the setting and feel like you know what you're doing and you'll have an answer for your players when they want to do something or whatnot. Like for instance, my players, they wanted to disguise themselves as enemy soldiers, as Texcoco warriors, Texcocan warriors. And I was like, well, you know, you guys are eagle and jaguar warriors. You have your really nice jaguar warrior war suit on. It's like this, you know, it's made from a leopard skin. The eagle warriors have their like war suits on that are like made from feathers. You guys are very proud of these warrior suits. It was a lot of effort to earn this thing. You're not going to want to put on an enemy warrior suit. Like that's just beneath you, you know, like you would, yeah. you just wouldn't do that. You're going to dishonor yourself by doing that. So I tried to explain it to them and they're like, oh yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So they found a different way to go about the problem they were trying to solve, which involved burning the forest down. but so, you know, I try to give you the reader as much information as I possibly could. And then I have an appendix B where I cite my sources. So these are the books and resources that I referenced that you could go look up for yourself as well. If you want even more setting information. But I think that you could use that chapter 7, like all of that reads like a history book, like a history book to me. So, you know, you have enough there to know something about the culture and run it competently, I think.
Yeah, that's good. And I think there's always opportunities with YouTube and, you know, local library to find topics as well. but it's good that it's actually part of the core book. And I think that's what's kind of good. It's just like you're mentioning, it's like, you know, we kind of have an idea of what it, you know, the way we think in modern day US, as far as what's honorable, what's not honorable, what's the way, the proper way to fight, what's not the proper way, what's cowardly. I mean, it's all changes, I think, with different cultures. It's not a uniform mm-hmm. view as far as, you know, honor and glory and whatnot. So
I think there's some overlap, like they're trying to reach the same goal, but they're going about it in like, in oftentimes like completely alien ways to us, you know, like we see what they're striving for, but they're just going about it in a way that's completely unfamiliar to us and alien to us. And so I get the hesitation of looking at this setting and being like, this is, I want to do it justice. I wanted to do it justice. That's why I spent, you know, 2 years researching this. I didn't just want to throw together like, here's my best guess on what Aztec society was like. I really, you know, I try to do the best that I could to research it.
Yeah, I was reading early on. You've got 67% to make up.
Yeah. As far as that genetic memory, you know. Yeah.
So it's, and I think that's, you know, for me, I mean, and I think, you know, and this is kind of hard. It's like I ran an adventure that was written, and it was set up in a pseudo, I'm not sure if it was, I can't remember if it was my, it might have been either mine or Aztec kind of vibe to it. But I just, all of a sudden, it's like there's stuff that wasn't given, and it's like you don't want to fall into jokey tropes either. So it's like it's good to have, you know, like all of a sudden, you know, if I got to come up with names, like, you know, like I don't want to go into jokey tropes, you know what I mean? It's, so it's kind of nice to have resources where you can flip through and throw out some names and have some ideas rather than just kind of, you know.
And I do give an NPC generator in there too. So you can roll up for, you roll up for like name, you roll up for social class, you roll up for profession, and you roll up for like their attitude, you know, like their temperament. And I also have a glossary in the back that shows a lot of the common words in the Nahuatl language and like how to pronounce it. So like you have the phonetic pronunciation. So you can look at some of the words, like if you look at the glossary, and I have a section at the very beginning of like how to pronounce words, you can start to figure it out. But I will tell people to don't feel bad if you butcher a word. I still butcher them all the time. It's weird. I was saying on my own stream last night, you know, language wise, our mouths are not designed to speak this language.
Yes.
You know, our muscles are not developed to speak in this way in our mouth. And so it's hard. And so don't feel bad if you can't say a word. I'll tell people that too. Cause a lot of people have that concern, like, oh, I don't know how to say these words. So it kind of makes me not want to run the setting. And it's like, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You know, just have fun.
Yeah. And I think that if you're especially going to run from the table, you just need to say it. Well, there was the, kind of a funny story. There's a E.B. White was telling, I'm going to mess it up now. There's a book on Elements of Style by Strunk, who's a professor and English professor. And E.B. White relates the stories. You know, the professor, I guess he would just make these bold pronunciations. He's like, if you're going to say a word, say it boldly. He goes, don't mingle the sin of ignorance with the sin of inaudibility. So go ahead and do your best. I would say if you're running from the table, and just do your best and say it and move on. And nobody's going to know the wiser and you're treating it, I think, with respect at that point.
I think like it's intention and you're trying hard and, you know, it's, you know, that's all that matters. You know, as you have 33% permission for me to mispronounce the words. So,
you know, you trapped me into doing the math, and I'm like, no, I have to go further out in the generations. I can't just go to grandparents. I have to go to great grandparents. Now I'm still trying to figure out how to get to 33%. So that'll be a math problem. Maybe my high school algebra will come into play there, where I can come up with a formula.
I only know what it is. A while ago, my mother-in-law, she's into like genealogy and stuff like that. And she wanted to know, she had exhausted her side of the family and my father-in-law's side of the family, as far as like, cause she took an ancestry.com. genetic thing and went all the way back in time to know where they came from and whatnot. And she's like, well, we want to know about, you know, your family and stuff. So she got me a kit for Christmas. And I was like, oh, I already kind of knew, obviously.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in a Mexican-American household. But like, I was like, oh, I'm 33% indigenous people of Mexico. And just to like the, a lot of it is like just to the west of where Tenochtitlan was.
So that's how you came up. I was thinking of through marriage. So I was trying to work out the math. So if you, you know, first I was if you have one grandparent that was indigenous, you know, and then, you know, how does that work out with the averages with your parents? And then it was just like turning into, so now it makes more sense thinking with 33%. I was like, how'd you come up with 33%? That makes sense.
Yeah. it was just the genetic, like where, you know, it was pretty cool. It was really neat to see. And then my mother-in-law went crazy, you know, because I'm 33% indigenous people of Mexico and then 35% Spanish. And then I'm a bunch of random stuff like Portuguese and Basque and all kinds of weird stuff like that mixed thrown in there as well, which makes sense with the Spanish. Portuguese and Basque are like, you know, Basque is in Spain. It was pretty cool. She did some research, and I guess like one of my ancestors, they'd been in California on the Spanish side since like 1775. They were on the Anza expedition in 1775. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. Thanks for discovering that for me. That's neat.
Wow. Yeah, it's kind of wild. I've never routed, as far as my family history, I've never really attempted a bunch of miscreants and drunkards, so I decided not to go too far. don't want to peek too far into that.
It's fun. You might get further back and find something cool, though, you know, like what I did. It's neat.
I have a cousin on the other side. So that's the Jones side is just a bunch of miscreants. The Miller side, I had a cousin who wrote this long and elaborate genealogy.
Oh.
And it's quite long, and you know, with coats of arms and all that kind of stuff. And I think I found my mom's stuff, and I said something to him. He's like, oh yeah, he made it all up. It was just a joke. I mean, he just wrote. It was a bunch of just nonsense, which he's kind of ashamed of it, you know, after. But I thought, that's just funny. I wish I would have done it.
That is funny.
Yeah. It's interesting too. It's like, you know, the questioning is, you know, and I think the problem is, you know, the question is, if you're writing something that is of a different culture, you know, what is the right thing to do if you're not from that culture, how to approach it?
Yeah. I mean, for me, like I would have made this regardless of whether I was connected ancestrally to it or not, because I think it's a cool point in history. It's a really interesting culture and society. And so I think the way to go about it is you have to do your due diligence and do your research. You know, I think that's the best thing that you can do is, like, if you're going to pick a culture, if you're going to pick a society, like we were just talking about, like, oh, I don't want to fall into jokey tropes, you know, is to do the best you can to kind of represent that culture to the best of your ability. And I mean, that's what I tried to do with this. Like I knew things, little things here and there, having again grown up in a like Hispanic household, about this kind of stuff, but it's obviously not complete still. And so like I had to do lots of research. I had to read a lot of books and stuff like that to learn this. And I took 2 years of researching just the setting, just this point in history to start making this, you know. And then you get to the point of like, how do I gamify all this historical stuff? And you know, I just did the best that I could. And I think that's all anyone can ever ask of you, no matter what you're making, right?
Right.
You know, is to just do the best you can in representing what you're trying to do as true and as authentically as you can.
But I find this whole, it's kind of going back to that, you know, this is all brought based off the Twitter question that was raised to you. But I think, I mean, the idea is, you know, historically, things haven't been great as far as there have been like Black people who have invented whole genres, and white people take the music and then they become rich off of it and sure. move on. And like, I kind of get that, but then you're also dealing with a culture that's no longer in existence, mm-hmm. you know, it's historical. And then the other question is, you know, your challenge on your bona fides based off of your, you know, of your blood, of your heritage to what you said. Yeah, I'm 33%. But the question is what percent, but that, yep. that satisfied, yep. they didn't really care that you were accurate. They cared that somebody, then I'm thinking like, what percentage did you need? I mean, they were fine with 33%. Would they have been not fine with 32%? Like yeah. what point is like, it's a very interesting, it's very interesting where we're at. I don't know.
Well, you know, I think I'm lucky in that, like, this person that questioned me gave me a pass, you know, and I think for the most part, I have gotten a pass because I'm the quote, right race. I'm the quote, right color and everything. Right. And I've tried to be clear, like, I'm not doing it because of that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing it because I really care about this culture and setting and representing it truthfully.
Right. And that's separate from who you are genetically.
Yes. It's, you know, I joked on Twitter. I said, I'm 33%, but I didn't inherit any ancestral memories to like, just, I didn't pop out of the womb knowing who Quetzalcoatl was, you know, I had to research all this stuff. I still had to spend time learning, from experts. And, you know, that, I think that's, and I'm kind of the point where like, I almost regret posting that tweet. Of that question to me or like engaging with it, but I did feel like it was kind of important at the same time too, and I tried to address it tactfully and professionally. But I at the same time I kind of want to like move past it, because I have received a couple questions just on the Kickstarter itself, like in messages, people have messaged me asking the same question. And I think I just got to a point where I was just kind of tired of answering it. So, you know, I wanted to make my position clear. And so then I made a tweet talking about why I'm doing what I'm doing and, you know, the reasons behind it and the research that I put into it. You know, I want to be patted on the back because I did a good job doing research and making a cool game, not because I have the right blood in my veins.
Right. Because you could have been, you know, 33% and just presented a jokey game that was nothing but tropes.
Yeah. And I probably could have gotten away with that too.
but their concern, I guess there's two aspects. They were concerned about historicity or any sort of representation. It's just who was the one getting the money for it. So I think that was their concern, which is, I don't know. It's just, it's a very, you know, I think what's happened is, you know, society's been one direction. I think there's a lot of movement towards maybe too far in another direction. But eventually I think the pendulum will even out somewhere where it should be.
I hope so.
It's like, leave me alone. It's like,
I just want to be a Jaguar warrior. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. why do we get to get into this? But I mean, I think for at least what I can tell from the art to what you've stated, to the images that have been presented, the books, the mechanics, it just sounds like you've got an absolutely spectacular package, and that if anybody can pry out $32, they need to pry out $32 for that. I just still can't get over that price. So
my Atomic Punk game, for instance, on DriveThruRPG, I think it's like $12 for like physical version of the game and $8 for the PDF. I'm not out here to like rob people. I just want to get my game in your hands, you know, and have help you have a good time playing something fun that I made. Like, that just brings me joy. So,
well, yeah. I think for me, what I like about it, I mean, for me, you know, what I think is, do I really need one more games setting system that I'm not going to play? Probably not. But then when I look at what you've done, there's a number of levels why this is interesting to me. One is just the layout and the graphic design and stuff that you've done is great. I think the treatment of a historical setting and having that in a you know, you can go watch videos or read books, but this is history written for the gamer to run a game. So it's like condensed and direct. And I think that's important. And I think you also offer a lot of very interesting mechanics that maybe I would never, ever, you know, modify or use, but still it's worthy of adding to the overall gamosphere. Because who knows what's going to come out of people, you know, people invent things and then other people do stuff and it builds mm-hmm. on it. And, you know, it's how we get there. So in a lot of ways, I'm excited to see what new things you're adding. And who knows what 5 years from now, 10 years from now may develop, you know, from what you're adding to what people have already done.
Yeah, that'd be cool. I mean, I've had people tell me like, oh, I'm looking forward to your game, not because I'm going to necessarily run it as is. I'm not going to run like an Aztec game necessarily, but they're like, I have a tropical part or like a part that's very similar geographically to Mexico in my setting. And I want to put an Aztec culture there. And I think that's cool. Like you could totally take what I've done and put it in have your Western characters move in, or even your Eastern, whatever it is that your setting is. And you have another culture that you can drop in right there, and you have spells. There's 37 new spells that are like fit the setting, and it's going to make that area of your game world feel unique, even if you're not running a necessarily historical game either. You know, so I tried to make it so that it could be used in a lot of different ways like that as well. So it could be something that you supplement your current campaign with. It could be something you want to run as is, or you know, pick apart and cannibalize it for stuff that you do like, or, you know, so whatever you want to do.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, I, you know, with RuneQuest is probably one of the games I'd really want to run or play, but the problem is it's very complex. Later editions mm-hmm. got even more complex, but it's just like, and it's set in a Bronze Age. Be derisive of it, but it's like it's a pagan setting. The gods, it's very much set into the way the gods interact and people do and the cults. I mean, it is like full on, you know, religion's real, the gods are real, and these things are all happening. And I see what you're doing here, and I kind of wish that, you know, they could have something that would be less rules crunchy and more where you can engage in the setting. So I think what you offer here is a very a good path to get into a non-European style setting in a way that's very approachable and doable and not requiring a tremendous amount of rules to learn.
Or conversion, if you're like, I like the RuneQuest stuff, but I want to try and convert it to this other system that I run. And now you're like pulling your hair out. And
yeah, it would not work for users for RuneQuest, but I just think it's like it's a similar... it's a different approach to older cultures, even though RuneQuest it's still aping on some cultures. They created their own cultures, but it's mm-hmm. I don't know. It's very cool. It's on Kickstarter for 26 days to go. You're at 8. You're almost funded.
Really? I haven't checked it.
Say almost 8,000. So yeah. Okay. And I was also, do you ever look on KickTrack?
No, I don't even know what that is. This is my first Kickstarter I've ever done. So
copy so go to kicktrak.com.
T-R-A-Q?
Yeah.
Okay. And then put the URL in?
Yeah, or you just type in the name of either way.
Let's see. Okay.
So it's going to tell you that you're trending towards $61,000, but you're not really going to hit $61,000. I like looking at is the daily data tab.
Okay.
And you had a very reasonable good start, and you are cranking out pretty stinking good right now. So
that's good to see. I didn't know about this website. This is very useful.
Yeah. So you've not really hit the bathtub yet. So you are in a really strong position to know, to do well with this, and you should, because you've got a super solid product. I think you, if anything, you may have, you could have probably charged more money, but you are wanting to spread the, you're wanting to spread the book, not the make the money, but my goodness, $30 for a hardback book of that quality. Yeah.
I mean, I guess one of the last things I'll say is, you know, I was, you know, I, not that I expected to fail or anything. I don't look, go out looking to fail, but I was like worried, you know, going into this, this is like a niche within a niche within a niche.
Yeah.
You know, and I was just flabbergasted at the first day when I was 50% funded, and I was like, holy smokes. Okay. People do want to be an Eagle Warrior. This is cool. This is cool. So I'm incredibly humbled and grateful to everyone that's backed this project and has like been cheering me on. It's been really, I don't know how to describe it. Like, I don't want to sound cheesy or whatever, but like, it's been very humbling, and I can't express how grateful I am to the support people have given.
I remember there's a friend of mine who was a pastor at a church, and he was starting out and just starting in a new town. And these things were not going good, not getting people to attend. And it was complaining to his dad. And his dad told him, says, you know, son, nobody asked you to come here. So, nobody asked you to make this Aztec game, right? Nobody's asked us. You know, it is really, it can be very hard, and it is an act of faith to really put money and time and effort into something that could bomb.
It's like, it's 2 years of work. Is it just going to fall flat on its face when I, you know, present it to the public? You know, and I'm so grateful that it hasn't done that. You know,
no, I think. Oh, go ahead.
I can say it still could, I guess, in theory, but I, you know,
you will at least hit 10,000. I don't know where, I can't predict where it's going to go, but it very well could hit. I would say it could hit 15 or 20,000, probably pretty easy. It depends how it's all good. Because what it looks like to me, looking at this at the daily data, is you're getting new people all the time. So it's not like, what will happen is it'll peter out for a while, and then towards the end, it'll pick back up.
That's what my friend said. Everyone's like, oh, it's ending. I better get on board with that. It's ending right now. I better back it.
Yeah. And people who do that, I'm glad that people always back at any time. But boy, that just adds the stress.
my buddy, I do Natural Ones with him. He's my co-host on Natural Ones, Victor Gorchev. And he did a Modern Guns and Gear supplement for 5th edition. And he said, like, he got the last 30% of what he needed in like the last day. And he said it, he was just sweating bullets.
I knew two people that happened within a short period of time. And I would have told both of them. And one of them, I actually kind of hinted, he may just want to kill it and start over again. And they both did it. They both made it at the end. And I could not believe it.
Yeah. He was stressing. I felt bad for him. So.
Oh, yes. It's hard. So, yeah, that $10,000, I mean, that's not an easy number. I've not reached 10,000 yet. I've been pushing for it, but it's not an easy number to get. But I think the main thing is just get the word out. So, and I think that's what it is with the RPG community. If you do put out something of quality and you are able to at least get some people to hear it, people will buy it. So I guess, do you have any ways that you want people to reach you, John?
Sure, they can find me on YouTube. I have a YouTube channel. So if you're interested in like hearing me talk about old school games and whatnot, you can find me on there. I stream every Monday night. And I have other games too, if you're interested in, if people are out there watching or interested in that. They're a little rough around the edges. I feel like, you know, with each thing I've created, I've tried to improve myself and be better and better. But if you like cowboy stuff, I have it's not D&D based at all. It's its own sort of D6 dice pool game. It's Cowpunchers Reloaded. It's like, that one is just another like straight Western sort of historical thing. And I sort of went like, if you're a gun guy, I sort of went crazy on the guns. So a big chunk of that book is just statting out guns for that game. So if you're into that kind of stuff and you want to be a cowboy, you can use that. You can play that game. And then I have Atomic Punk. My website's thebasicexpert.com. You can even get print on demand there. So if you're into the Lulu prints. I use Lulu for print on demand on my website. So
yeah, I use Lulu for print on demand for my website as well. As well as far as what I also use is Lulu for international backers.
Yeah, they do a nice job, and they're a little more expensive than DriveThruRPG and Lightning Source, but I think their books are slightly better quality. So
yeah. Well, good luck, Jonathan, and we'll have to catch you again with your next project.
We'll see what, I don't know what it's going to be. We'll see what it'll be. I'm going to probably, take a break after this.
I hear you.
I'm going to be tired, I'm sure.
Yeah. So anyway, good luck with the Kickstarter, and we'll catch you on the rebound.
Thank you.